This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. If you're a regular listener of public radio, then you're probably familiar with our guest this hour.
This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Joe and Terry Graydon have been dispensing holistic health advice on their nationally syndicated radio show for decades. They may even seem like family to some listeners, but there's a lot about this duo that you might not know. For instance, the People's Pharmacy wasn't always a team effort. It all started when Joe was writing the follow-up to his popular first book. He also had a newspaper column to write, and he was getting a little behind in his work. He needed help to finish, and that's when Terry stepped in. She began co-writing both the column and the book, and that led Terry to join Joe on his radio show as well. They've continued to work closely through the years. Between the two of them, Joe and Terry have written 19 books and co-hosted the wildly successful People's Pharmacy radio program. They've appeared on network TV. They've maintained a website that's become a forum for people with all kinds of medical questions. Their latest book is called Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. It's a guide to staying alive as you navigate the medical system. Joe and Terry Graydon are with me right now in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to join you today.
The two of you have become very well known for your health advice. Tell us how you became interested in the medical field. I'll start with you, Terry.
I became interested in really in nutrition and health to start with. I was a graduate student in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was thinking about specializing in linguistic anthropology, and my very first class was a class in Black English. And for the term paper, I was to tape record. This is in the days of tape recorders. I was to tape record a sample of somebody talking and in Black English, and then do the phonemic analysis. In 1969, in Ann Arbor, nobody was interested in allowing me to tape record them talking. They said, we in the Black community in Ann Arbor have been studied this way and that for years, for decades, and we have never gotten anything back to benefit us from all of your academic endeavors. So the answer is no. And I had no idea where I was going to get my sample. But luckily, my roommate had a sister with the Children's Defense Fund, which was allied with the Welfare Mothers of Detroit, a nearby large city. And these welfare mothers were suing the school board of the city of Detroit because they said that the meals being provided for the children were inadequate. So Caroline's sister managed to arrange for me to record the pretrial hearings. And I did my term paper, I did the recording, I did my term paper, and discovered I was much more interested in what the welfare mothers were saying about how they fed their families than in how they actually said it phonemically.
So you become interested then in nutrition and health.
I did.
All right.
And nutrition and health go hand in hand.
Joe, how about you?
When I was a kid, I read a book about schizophrenia and autism, and I was just fascinated. It was like one of those magic moments, and I said, I need to know more about what's going on inside the brain. And I studied psychology and science in college and then went on to do and also became very interested in sleep research. Bill Dement, who was the grandfather of all sleep research at Stanford, came and gave a talk. It was like, wow, the dawn of REM, rapid eye movement sleep, and how we can actually tell whether you're dreaming or not. And I thought, this is cool stuff. But I was a Quaker, Society of Friends, and so I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War. And so as soon as I graduated college, I started my two-year CO service at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute in Princeton, New Jersey, in a laboratory of neuropharmacology, of all things. And while there, fell in love with pharmacology, and in particular neuropharmacology, and then went on to graduate school where we, Terry and I, finally met.
Well, that's the bathing cap story. But we need to get to the LSD story first. This is where you were introduced. They were using LSD in that lab, right?
We had probably one of the world's largest collections of Sandoz, which is the pure pharmaceutical grade LSD in this country, if not in the world at that time, because the company had stopped making it, and we had somehow, the leadership of the lab had hoarded this huge quantity. And in my refrigerator, which is the lab that I was working in, I just had cartons and cartons, and inside each carton were vials and vials. So it was like this immense amount. And we were studying it in both rabbits and rats, because the laboratory was looking at hallucinations. We figured schizophrenia equals hallucinations, LSD equals hallucinations. What's the commonality? And we were doing what were called quantitative electroencephalograms. My mentor, Dr. Leonid Goldstein, had come from France and had brought this technology to this country. So we were looking at the way in which we analyze the brainwaves of rabbits and rats on not just LSD, but all sorts of neurochemicals, you know, psilocybin, other kinds of hallucinogens, as well as drugs like Valium and Librium and antipsychotic medications like Haldol.
So you're looking at changes in brainwaves, hoping to come up with some insight into what schizophrenia and other profound mental disorders. Of course, neuroscience has come a long way, and we know that one brainwave doesn't tell us too much.
But, exactly. But there's a lot of disappointment that we have not unlocked the secrets of the brain.
So how did you two meet?
Well, that's the bathing cap story. I had finished my swim at the swimming pool in the apartment complex where I was subletting for the summer, and I was reading a magazine, and this young woman comes up to me and asks if I'm done with my bathing cap and can she borrow it, please, because the swimming pool required you to wear a bathing cap. So, sure, I lent her my bathing cap, and after she finished her swim, and she was a really good swimmer, after she finished her swim, she returned it to me and introduced me she was a little unclear about the relationship of this man. She implied that they were married, but she didn't actually say it. So I met Joe and Jeannie at that point.
And the rest is history, and we've been married now 41 years.
Yeah, but you were somebody else's boyfriend at the time.
Well, he was.
At the time, yes.
A little obstacle there.
But it didn't take very long before Terry and I realized that we were the ones who needed to be together. Jeannie has gone on to become quite an extraordinary journalist in her own right, and had an amazing piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine section just yesterday about PSA testing and prostate cancer.
Wow. So you get together. I don't know if you kept the bathing cap. It's great that you two actually, you know, go back to a time when bathing caps were required in pools and LSD was available in a lot of laboratories. This is how far back you go.
Yeah, we're all.
And I'm back there with you, so you're not alone. Tell us about the People's Pharmacy. How did that come about?
Well, Terry dragged me kicking and screaming off to Oaxaca, Mexico to do her dissertation research.
All the good places we've gone in our lives. I've dragged him kicking and screaming. It's great.
And it was the best 2 years of our lives. I was teaching in the medical school there to second-year medical students. I had gotten my master's degree in pharmacology from University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. And Terry was doing her dissertation research. But in the afternoon, my classes were over. I was in the hammock, and I'm a kind of type A personality, as you can imagine. And I just felt like I ought to be doing something. And that doing something was trying to write a book about pharmaceuticals and health in general for the layman. There was nothing up until that point. Pharmaceuticals, your prescription medicines, it was a deep, dark secret. And as they say, the rest was history. When we came to Durham, because Terry got a job at the Duke School of Nursing, the book came out, and to everyone's surprise, was quite successful.
Did you drag him?
I absolutely dragged him here, kicking and screaming. In fact, he made a foray to try and find us a place to live. He called me up that evening, and he said, "Well, you can come to Durham if you want to. I'm going back to Mexico, where it's civilized."
It is the story of the settlement of North Carolina. The women folk leave, but they all come back with a man, so they stay. Well, now, what were you doing in Oaxaca?
I was studying nutrition and health. I was working in a squatter settlement in the city of Oaxaca. It's the one that goes up the hill towards Monte Alban, the big ruin there. And people were wonderful. It was, I just loved wandering around in San Juanito and talking to people about what they had for breakfast. or lunch or dinner.
So you both had your study there. You come back. You finally make it to Durham. How long did it take you to settle into Durham, Joe?
It took a few years. But now, of course, you couldn't drag me out of here for any amount of money, for love, for anything, because I have my love. We have our passion, which is in large measure radio, because we love radio more almost than anything else we do. And Durham is a wonderful place to live and work. So this is it. Never leaving again.
Tell us how the radio show got started.
The radio show is a pretty much of an accident. Back in the late 70s, I did some interviews at National Public Radio right around Thanksgiving, I'm guessing, probably 1976, 77. And Jackie Judd and David Mulpas were on board in those days. You probably remember those names well. And they said, hey, kind of like your stuff. We'd like you to do commentaries for NPR, especially on the weekends. So I did commentaries for a few years. And then our general manager at WUNC at that time, jazz aficionado Gary Shivers, I went to Gary and I said, hey, Gary, could I do a talk show? And he said, well, yeah, Saturday morning. I think he thought nobody was listening. And so he gave me a shot. And then Terry joined me in the mid-80s.
We will talk about that and how the collaboration began when our conversation with Joe and Terry Graydon, host of The People's Pharmacy and authors of the new book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them, continues on The State of Things, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Joe and Terry Graydon, host of The People's Pharmacy and authors of the new book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. And just before the break, Joe, we were talking about how the show came into being here on WUNC first. Tell us about that show originally. You were all alone. You're doing that show by yourself, right?
All alone, once a month, and it was awful, Frank. I mean, really, really bad. Because, you know, I'd been a guest on so many radio shows and TV shows all across the country, flogging my books. And I thought it was about me. And as you well know, anytime a host thinks it's about him or her, it's a disaster. And it really was. The first few years were really horrible. I finally figured it out. You need to listen to your guests.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What was it, Joe?
And it's all about them. And that's when Terry came on board. Wow. And as soon as Terry joined the show, it changed 180 degrees.
Well, I think we have a transitional moment here, a moment, obviously, maybe that Terry wasn't on board fully, but clearly she was about to become a member. Let's listen.
Good morning, and welcome to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon, and today we're talking about anything on your mind. Joining me in the studio is Melva Okun, my producer, and Terry Graydon, my wife. And we are going to discuss drugs, topical health issues, and your questions.
So she wasn't yet the co-host, I guess, at that moment? Or
not yet.
Yeah.
It took a while before I really stepped up to the plate as co-host. I think I started so that Joe would have somebody to talk to during those shows where he didn't have a guest in the studio.
Open phones.
Yes, exactly.
Open phones.
You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, but it's all bad when it's open phones. So here you are, kind of not initially recognizing, but also I guess Terry was helping you with some of your commentaries as well.
Sure. She was not only helping with the commentaries because they were coming in large measure from our syndicated newspaper column, but we became a team about 1979, 1980. I got in over my head on a book deadline and realized that I wasn't going to be able to make it. And in those days, we were living from advance to advance. And if I didn't make it, we were going to have to pay back the advance. So it was really scary times. Terry stepped up to the plate. She contributed both to the book, a whole chapter on nutrition. And then she started writing the newspaper column.
Well, we had a routine already in which we would sit down on, Thursday, middle of the day, I think. Mind you, this is in the days before email, okay, before fax machines.
This might be before word processors.
The first ones were absolutely on a typewriter. Yeah. We did have one of those really nice electric typewriters. Still have it, actually, the old Selectric. But we'd sit down Thursday, middle of the day, and Joe would tell me what he was thinking he was going to write in the newspaper column. And I would give him some feedback about it. Well, what about this and what about that? and then he'd go off and ride it. So that was my input at first. And then as he had to be spending more and more time trying to finish the book that he had not really begun writing when it ought to have been begun, he would say, I don't think I can write the column this week. But, you know, you can't take an incomplete on a newspaper column. Mm-hmm. So we would then talk about what needed to be in the column, and I go write the column while he was writing the book.
Now, I was figuring my editor would, of course, notice instantly that the column had gone downhill dramatically overnight. Au contraire, the editor was like, wow, this column is so much better. You're really getting it now at long last. And I was like, my ego was completely deflated.
How did you feel about that? Yeah,
I was deflated. But then I realized, you know, this is a team effort. It's not about me. It's not about my ego. It's about helping consumers, readers, listeners understand better how to make decisions about
Their
health.
That really come to you quickly? Or
pretty
did you
fast.
Really,
it did.
It
yeah. really
it
did.
Took a little while.
It took a little while. Once I got over, you know, the column is so much better. But, you know, it really did benefit dramatically from Terry's input and ultimately from her writing.
What about on the show, Terry, when you became a regular, when you were essentially co-hosting, did you take to radio right away? Were you comfortable with it?
No, not right away. There were actually several years in which everyone associated with the radio show would say, I can't hear you. You have to talk louder. And then they would say, and you have to talk more. And my whole life I've been told I talk too much and I should shut up once in a while. So that was a new experience. But I think we've kind of got it worked out most of the time now.
You sure do. And that's the thing. How long did it take you? Because now it is such a smooth transition. The two of you go back and forth and it sounds so smooth and almost like you rehearsed it. But clearly you can't. You can't rehearse that.
You cannot rehearse it. We don't work from scripts. And it's just the flow. It's the way we work on the computer. We trade seats back and forth. Somebody has a good idea. Ooh, let me sit down and write. And same thing on the radio. I mean, sometimes we wave at each other, but that's about it.
The audience has always been a very important part of your show. They contribute ideas, they ask questions, and your relationship. How long did it take you to develop that kind of relationship with your listeners?
I think the connection with the listeners was an important thing right from the start. Even before the radio show, certainly before I was involved with the radio show, we were getting mail from the newspaper column, and we would get, you know, these big tubs of actual mail with stamps on it, you know, written out by hand. And it was great to have that connection with the people who were reading the column. Same thing with the radio show. It was a live show. There were listeners calling in every week. And so you got instant feedback about what people were interested in.
And what we learned was that I was wrong. Because I really thought that what everybody wanted was double-blind, placebo-controlled trial information, straight-ahead science. Let's not talk about the fruits and nuts and touchy-feely and all that alternative wacko stuff. But Terry was bringing her medical anthropology, and she was saying, wait a minute, people's experiences count. Their remedies are important. Nutrition is important. They want to know about this stuff. And darned if they didn't. And we paid attention to our listeners. And starting about the mid-80s, early 90s, we began incorporating a lot of their questions into the show. And pretty soon, it was at least 50-50 and then maybe even more.
Well, people really are interested in alternatives. They really would prefer not to take as many drugs as, you know, are sometimes prescribed, and they'd like to know other ways to do things. And what we found when we really started looking into it is there is some science. And sometimes there's quite a bit of science to back up other ways of doing things.
How was it at first? Because you do end up walking a line. People's experience makes for a remarkable radio. We know that. But then when we're talking about science, we're talking about medicine. People are calling for advice. Did you feel like, oh, we've moved into some worrisome territory here where ends up, even if it's not our advice, sounding like medical advice?
We do need to be really careful. We continue to need to be really careful to make sure that people know we're not telling them what to do. We're not practicing medicine. Neither of us is a doctor. You know, their doctors know more about their particular health situation than we ever would.
Well, something happened on the radio shortly after Terry joined the show. She said, we don't know. And I thought lightning was going to strike, because up until that point, even if I didn't know, I was dodging and weaving and pretending as if I did. Or if somebody asked about oranges, I would try to talk about, you know, grapefruit and do it in a way that they didn't know that I had just done this little two-step. But Terry said, "I don't know." And nothing bad happened. And all of a sudden, that was okay to admit we don't know. We don't know everything. In fact, there's a lot we don't know. And I think our listeners appreciate when we admit that we don't know. And we try to get the science whenever we can find it. And sometimes we say, there is no science. We don't know why putting a bar of soap under the bottom sheet would be at all helpful against leg cramps. Nobody's done any research on it. It could be the placebo effect, but if it might help and it won't hurt and it doesn't cost very much,
why not?
Mm. Yeah, well, and we don't know why aspirin works.
They've got at least some ideas about how aspirin works, but it certainly took them 85 years to even come up with hypotheses, and they're still sort of hypotheses.
They're still figuring it out. You're right.
So what do you do? You talked about these epiphanies, these sort of lightning strikes for you. I don't know doesn't mean end of the show. But you said you were devoted to this kind of rigorous science. What did it take for you? Was it a quick transition for you to convert to this different kind of program, or did you have to be one of
kicking and screaming?
Yeah,
I was very reluctant. It actually took a dear friend of ours, Dr. Tom Ferguson, who we collaborated with for very many years before he died. And he and I got into a really shouting match about evidence versus experience. And he basically convinced me that experience was worthwhile and listening to people was important and honoring what happened to them. And I think that began to open the door where I didn't have to have a placebo-controlled trial to talk about it.
There were some hints and inklings even earlier than that. At one point, Joe's uncle said to him, "Joe, it seems that every time his partner, who had, you know, heart issues and was on a beta blocker, he said, this drug seems to be making her feet so cold, and or that she couldn't stop it. I don't remember which was the problem."
He said she's addicted to her propranolol, a beta blocker, mm-hmm. a drug that's prescribed quite frequently. And I said, "Uncle Leo, that's impossible. This drug is not addicting." Several years later, we learned that suddenly stopping beta blockers made people feel very uncomfortable, gave them irregular heart rhythms, and sometimes heart attacks. And I thought,
So Mary was right after all.
How was your show received in the medical community and in scientific communities as you moved into this new territory early on?
You know, I think it's been a mixed response. There are some physicians who love the show in large measure because we interview very highly regarded scientists from all over the world, and we talk science. And evidence is evidence, and that's great, and we love it, and they love it. I think when we start talking about some of the home remedies, for example, for skin conditions, the dermatologists shiver.
Well, you know, it really is very individual. We do hear from physicians who say, I wish you would not do all that weird stuff. And we hear from doctors who say, you know, I love your show. I love all those home remedies.
Things have changed, though, haven't they? I mean, the medical community is now coming around to at least honoring experience and working it into some of the research, more qualitative kind of research going on.
Well, you interviewed Dr. Brantley recently from Duke Integrative Medicine, and there's a wonderful example of a physician who is open to all sorts of experience and looking at the science to support it. And there are, I think, a lot more physicians who are open to possibilities. And there is no one answer for everyone, and I think that's what we're learning as well. You know, some people, just give me the antibiotic, just give me the blood pressure pill. There are other people who say, help me lose weight. Help me learn how to meditate.
But the infrastructure is changing too. It's not just that Dr. Brantley is interested all by himself. He's got a building, and it's got Duke's name attached to it. That is relatively new or changing. Would you say? I mean, you would know better than me.
I do think that's relatively new.
And it's happening all across the country. I mean, it's happening in Arizona. It's happening at the VA. I mean, that's what's so amazing. I mean, Tracy Gaudette, MD, who used to be at Duke Integrative Medicine, is now at the Veterans Administration and shaking it up.
I tell you, when my father was at the VA, where, by the way, he got the best medical care. He had private care, and he dropped that for socialized medicine. I just want to make that point. But anyway, he got the best possible care there. And one of the things they kept, we would look at all the numbers and they'd be changing all the time. And then we started to get just smart enough to be a pain in their neck. But one of the things they would do is say, look, it's not all about numbers. You're really going to have to relax about these numbers. There are a lot of things. And really how he feels is very important to us. Now, these are cardiologists. This is the chief cardiologist, you know, at the La Jolla VA with her whole team. So it's not like it's a bunch of woo-woo hippies coming in telling us, how's your daddy feel? I was actually pretty surprised that they were telling us to relax about the numbers. There are a whole lot of other things. They were certainly looking at the numbers. There were many, many more things that went into his care.
There, and this is something that we are seeing and hearing from cardiologists as well as other specialties, is that some doctors, not all doctors, but some doctors are really starting to pay attention to the patient's experience. How does the patient actually feel?
Well, one of my uncles said, it's not how long you live, it's how you live that counts. And I think that's a really good motto, because we can get your cholesterol down really low and the numbers will look absolutely gorgeous. But if you can't get out of bed because your muscles are in such pain and your joints hurt and you have no energy, have we really accomplished anything? So it's got to be numbers, but also quality.
You have a website in addition to the radio show, and you, it seems to me you have a far different audience on that website. People are really meeting and communicating on the website. Tell us about that.
Well, we didn't anticipate that the website actually would be a place for people to communicate with each other, but it has really turned out that way. We initially started just posting our information on the website, and then we spoke to a brilliant young man who said, why don't you accept comments? This is a good idea. And we said, oh, this is a good idea. Let's do it. And almost as soon as we did it, we were amazed at how many comments we started to get. And then people started in the comments talking to each other. So although we don't have a bulletin board, there are a number of different places where people are communicating with each other as though it were a bulletin board.
Well, it's a community. And that's sort of what radio is. I mean, there's an intimacy that's quite extraordinary, especially when calls come in. And I think that's what's happening on the website. It is an intimate community where people share some of the most personal stories. It sometimes astonishes me about those stories. And they also share sometimes the tragedies in their lives and their side effects. And that back and forth, it's magic.
And then they also share their interesting home remedies. And we get to learn a lot from people on the web.
I envy you, because really the fact is you've got this show. And honestly, Joe and Terry, you get to say things on the radio that I will never get to say in a million years, like this.
So you have some interesting smelling toes.
See, I can't do that. I could live 100 years and on this show we say, you know, class warfare may have begun, but you know, the thing I really notice about you, Professor Williams, you have some interesting smelling toes. Couldn't happen. But you do. I mean, the fact is you talk about sex, you talk about intimate parts that we don't want to talk about, including our toes. Does it get uncomfortable for you? It never sounds that way. It sounds almost charming all the time.
That's because of Terry. I mean, you hear that laugh, and almost whatever happens on the radio, no matter how bizarre, unexpected, unplanned, Terry is relaxed. She's calm. She's the calming influence. We have a dear friend who said, Joe's the bulldog. And Terry's the calm, very sweet. She's going to make everything okay. She's going to make people feel good. And I think that's right. We do have a kind of a Mutt and Jeff routine, but in reality, Terry's the flamethrower. I mean, she's much more radical than I am.
You have a show that stands out in your mind, or shows, particular shows that really stand out for you?
Well, I was afraid you'd
I
ask.
Hate this question, but whatever you say, I'm going to use it. I'm going to say my favorite show was the one about the
Well,
soap.
This wasn't necessarily my favorite show, but the show that took my breath away, this was before Terry joined it, was it was the end of the show. It was the last call. You know, we've learned over the years, you never take the last call.
It's always a mistake.
And this very sweet little old lady from Greensboro called in, and it was a sex show. And she said, I've lived my whole life. I'm now, I don't know, in my 80s, whatever it is. And I could never ask anybody, but how do homosexuals do it? And there was this little pause, but the person who was next to me, who was an expert, just picked it up immediately, gave her an answer, and she said, thank you so much. I would have died without knowing that. Oh, and by the way, do they kiss too? And it was handled perfectly. But it was like one of those moments you sort of go, can we do this on the radio? And we did. And the lightning strike didn't happen. And we just moved right on.
No, and far from it. In fact, what you were able to do is actually talk very honestly about something that needs to be talked about out loud. And you did it. That's great. Joe and Terry Graydon on the show. We're going to come back and talk about their new book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them, when our guest return, the host of the People's Pharmacy, Joe and Terry Graydon. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Talking this hour with Joe and Terry Graydon, host of the People's Pharmacy and authors of the new book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. And Joe, I know the death of your mother actually played a large role in inspiring this book. Tell us about that.
Well, we've spent the last 35 years trying to protect people from drug interactions. In fact, we even wrote a book called Deadly Drug Interactions. We've tried to warn them about drug side effects. We've tried to give them all of the tools they need to prevent harm to themselves or people they love. And I guess what's so painful about this particular story is that having done all that, I couldn't protect my mom. She was at Duke Hospital. She had gone in for what was considered a routine angioplasty. And of course, she was 92 years old, so it's never going to be routine in someone that age. But she was sharp as a tack. She was engaged. She was curious. She was totally involved with life. And she said, I'm going to do this because I have more to learn. Which I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Mm. And the doctors, although they might have been a little reluctant, they said, well, she's in otherwise pretty good health. We think we can do this procedure. We're going to do a cath and we'll see what happens. One artery out of five was closed up. They did the angioplasty. She came back to the room at 5 o'clock or thereabouts. She looked great. She was happy. She had entertained them during the procedure. They were laughing. She was disappointed they didn't know more about Voltaire. And she got a little indigestion after dinner. And the intern said, well, let me give her some morphine. I said, oh, no, no, no. You cannot give her any narcotics. She is intolerant of any opioids, which is what a narcotic is. So look in her chart. Make sure she just can't get that kind of drug, period. A fellow came by, a resident, and he gave her some Maalox. Boom. The indigestion went away. She was perfectly fine. She said, look, you're tired. Go home. I'm tired. I'm going to go to sleep. Come back. Get me tomorrow morning. We'll go home. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I get a call. Joe, I've been poisoned. Come quick. I'm in terrible trouble. Whoa. So I speed over to Duke Hospital. When I get there, she is going through involuntary muscle contractions. They've tied her legs to the bed. She's thrashing wildly. She is totally panicked. She is afraid. It was a disaster. And I asked, what happened? I left. She was great. Now it's a completely different patient. They had given her Demerol, which is a narcotic, and Phenergan, which is an antihistamine sedating. They had presumably wanted to keep her calm and sedated, and so she didn't move, because after an angioplasty, when they remove the sheath, you can bleed. Well, at 10 p.m., they removed the sheath, they gave her the Demerol, and then all hell broke loose because of a medication that she had been taking that interacted with the Demerol. It caused what we call serotonin syndrome, and the result is these uncontrollable muscle contractions. The next morning, she apparently tried to walk to the bathroom. I had gone home after she had gotten a little bit of sleep, coming back to get her, because I thought, we survived that. Oh, thank goodness. I didn't know what had actually happened. But just before I left the house to go back to the hospital, I get a call. Your mom has fallen on the way to the bathroom. Do you want life support? And I said, well, look in her medical chart. She did not want that. By the time I got to the hospital, she was dead, apparently from hemorrhage. there were a number of mistakes that were made. She should never have been allowed to walk on her own. She should never have been given the Demerol. But at the end result, it was mistakes after mistakes. And that led in part to writing the book, because we discovered that that kind of mistake is not uncommon.
And you, interestingly enough, chose not to sue Duke at the time.
No, we did talk to a lawyer, and he said pretty much there won't be many changes made. And at that point, we wanted change. We wanted Duke to become a safer place. And as a result, we ended up eventually on the Patient Safety and Clinical Quality Committee at Duke. We ended up on the Patient Advocacy Committee at Duke, trying over many years to make Duke a safer place, working with some very dedicated physicians there. And Terry, I would say I think Duke is a much safer place today than it was when my mom died.
I believe that's the case. Now, nonetheless, I think that all hospitals have the potential for danger, and people do need to be very careful. And one of the things that we say, any time that you have a family member going into the hospital, set up a schedule so that there will be a family member or a friend with them every single hour of the day to act as their advocate.
You, in your book, you point out that nationally there are something like 500,000 Americans who die every year because of medical mistakes. What's going on?
Our current medical technology is powerful, and it can save people, but it also can do a lot of damage if the dose is wrong, the timing's wrong, the diagnosis is wrong, and there are so many opportunities for things to go wrong. So when it works well, it is marvelous. When it doesn't work well, it's really awful.
Now, you've organized the book in terms of a number of top 10 lists, right? So let's start with the top 10 screw-ups that the doctors make.
Well, I think the number one screw-up is just not listening. There have been a number of studies in which people have actually put on a stopwatch to see how long it takes for a doctor to interrupt a patient after the patient starts telling the story. And quite frequently, it's around 20 seconds. The trouble is that when that happens, the patient doesn't get to tell the physician all of the possible things that could be contributing to the problem. And the doctor makes a very quick decision. Every doctor these days is under tremendous time pressure. And we're not bashing doctors. We're just saying the system is set up to be very difficult for them to have the adequate amount of time with the patient to get some of those little cues that might lead them in a different direction.
So the doctor is making a diagnosis within, you know, a minute or less of meeting the patient. And most of the time, the diagnosis that the doctor makes is right. But some of the time, maybe as much as a third of the time, you know, that first minute diagnosis missed something important.
Well,
and the diagnosis may be wrong.
We were absolutely astonished to discover during the course of researching this book that the number of misdiagnoses in this country in hospitals is up to 100,000, leading to death. Now, that's just not just misdiagnoses, but misdiagnoses that lead to death. When you add up all of the misdiagnoses, not just in hospital, but outside of the hospital, it's an astonishing number of people who are dying, which leads to what is the most important question you ask when the doctor gives you the diagnosis.
What else could it be, doctor? What symptoms do I have that don't fit this diagnosis? Those are two questions, but those are really important ones. And another question is, how sure are you that this is really what's going on? Now, the last one, unfortunately, sometimes we're really sure of ourselves and we're also not right.
Well, I've seen research that works with that focuses on doctors in particular in emergency rooms that shows something like 80% of the diagnoses that doctors will stick with it, even if they've shown new evidence that would contraindicate what they said. So it's very hard to change that initial
diagnosis. Hard to change. Dr. Jerry Groopman, who is a brilliant physician and wrote a wonderful book called How Doctors Think, calls this anchoring, that once the physician throws the anchor down and it lodges, it's hard to get it loose again. And so that's why it's so important for family and friends to say, what else could it be? How sure are you that this is what's causing my problem? You know, they've done a lot of autopsy studies over the years where somebody was diagnosed with condition X, then they died in the hospital, then they did an autopsy and they find out oh, it was really Y that caused the death? Well, that can happen up to 40% of the time. So don't be a statistic. Ask the right questions. Be assertive. Have an advocate.
Now, we talk about this, the number of deaths that because of medical mistakes of all kinds, misdiagnosis being just one. But to what extent does modern technology, the way we do medicine, are we saving people that otherwise would have died anyway? In other words, the medical mistake may have been the problem, but without that kind of intervention, without this kind of medicine, you may not have gotten this far. You may not have had the opportunity to have a mistake made on you.
Well, I mean, modern technology is wonderful, and certainly the CT scans have allowed us to diagnose, for example, appendicitis without doing exploratory surgery. I mean, that's a wonderful advance. The disadvantage is that sometimes we do too many of these. And, oh, it's a CAT scan. Kitty, 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 kitty. That's nice. Nobody realizes, oh, that could be as many as 400 chest x-rays. So we tend to overuse it sometimes when we don't need to. I think that the reality is that a lot of people go into the hospital for what they think is routine. Let's just say it's a knee surgery. And we have a case of a dear friend in Durham. The woman was very healthy, but she went in for a knee replacement. And what happened?
Well, she contracted an infection while she was recovering from her knee surgery, and the infection eventually killed her 2 weeks later.
So the surgery was a success, but the patient died.
So there, drug interactions is also another serious problem and a serious cause of death.
It is indeed. And we worry a lot about drug interactions. There are a lot of drugs on the market now that have the potential to cause a lot of damage if they're put together in the wrong combinations or wrong doses or sometimes just because.
There's a lot of technology in place, I thought, to keep that from happening these days. Is it happening much? Is it happening more than before?
Well, that was one of the great surprises in doing the research on this book, was that we thought the technology was there and doing its job. The physician now quite frequently is writing the prescription, not by hand with that illegible scrawl, but on either the computer or on a personal digital or smartphone, you know, some kind of a device, and it's going straight to the pharmacy. And the pharmacist has a computer. And so everybody is now checking for these incompatibility reactions because, let's face it, a lot of people are not taking one pill. They're taking half a dozen pills. They're taking nutrients. They're taking herbs. They're taking supplements. They're taking all kinds of stuff. Somebody needs to be checking. Well, what we found is that doctors frequently override what are called drug alerts or interaction alerts. And there's even a term for it.
Well, they call it alert fatigue, because so many alerts pop up in the course of a day that a doctor or a pharmacist says, yeah, this is the 18th alert I've seen, and I know that nothing bad happened when I went ahead and overrode the first 17.
Well, imagine you're driving down the road and the red engine light comes on. You know, you pull over, right? Because you know that if you keep driving and overheat, maybe the engine will blow up. Now, sometimes it's a false alert and you can get away with it, but you never really know. Well, the trouble is that doctors and pharmacists quite frequently are overriding these alerts that say you can't prescribe or dispense these two medications together. It could cause problems. That shocked us. And probably 100,000 people or more die every year because of adverse drug events, interactions, incompatibilities, and if people are overriding the alert, there goes the safety net.
And because people are moving around more and more, you might be moved from one hospital to a clinic to all over the place these days. Maybe not all of the drugs that you're taking has even made its way into the computer. Is that true?
Yes. Well, they might not move with you, let's put it that way. And those transitions are real danger points. So if you're moving from the hospital to a rehabilitation facility to recover from your knee replacement surgery, that's a danger point because important information about you might not make it with you.
Here's something we discovered. Lab results or bad news doesn't always get transferred or reported. We sort of work on the assumption, oh, no news is good news. Not always, because it may be that that lab result got buried on the doctor's desk. In one study, 14% of the time, doctors didn't tell patients about abnormal lab results. And in some clinics, it was as many as 1 in 4 abnormal results weren't transmitted. So here's the tip. You need to, A, ask the doctor, ask the nurse, ask whoever's in charge of the lab results, how are you going to get that information to me? Is it going to come by mail? Is it going to come by a phone call? Will it come as an attachment to an email? And
when? So you know when to expect it. And if you don't hear, give them a day or two. But if you don't hear after that, then get in touch and say, would you please give me my result?
That also suggests that you need to keep track. When they draw a vial of blood, there might be four tests that come from that. So you need to ask, what are you going to do with this? How many tests? What are they for? And then when?
Exactly.
Keep track.
Exactly right. You do need to keep track. And if you're feeling quite poorly because they're taking all this blood out of you, that's why they're taking it, then you need to have somebody there standing next to you writing all that stuff down. You can't count on being able to remember it.
And you need your medical record. I cannot emphasize this enough. In my mom's situation, her medical record disappeared because she'd been in the hospital a week before. When she came back, the medical record wasn't available. We didn't know that. You need your own personal medical record, whether it's electronic or paper. We don't care. Keep it with you. It's yours. You have every right to the information. And that way, if you go to another clinic, another doctor, wherever you may be, your medical record goes with you.
And or somebody else who may be Copus Mentis, in case they're going to medicate you, make sure somebody who's in charge, you know, has access to that record. Well, you obviously knew that much of this was going on. That's why you wrote the book. But what was the biggest surprise for you in putting this book together?
I think the biggest surprise for us is that nobody else seems to have looked at the big picture. And when we looked at the big picture, we found out that these numbers were much, much bigger than we anticipated. We've got researchers who are looking at deep vein thromboses, blood clots deep in the legs, sometimes in the arms, mostly in the legs, that can form after surgery or when someone is really immobile. And that's all they look at. And then they come up with this big number of people who suffer these things and who die as a consequence. But they're not looking at all of the other things that are going wrong within healthcare. So healthcare acquired infections, and there's a whole set of specialists just looking at the deaths from healthcare acquired infections. And when we added them all together, we were astonished.
Well, we talk about heart disease, we talk about cancer as the big killers, but what we found is healthcare harm is right up there, maybe number one, the killer in America today.
And you will find out more when you read the book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. My guest, Joe and Terry Graydon, host of the radio show, The People's Pharmacy. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
People's Pharmacy airs on WUNC Saturdays at 7 a.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. The book is called Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. Joe and Terry are going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill this Wednesday at 7:30. Going to be at the North Carolina State Fair on Saturday the 15th. And then next week, they're going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on the 18th and Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on the 19th. You can learn more about Terry and Joe at peoplespharmacy.com. We are at stateofthings.com, and we share a website. We're close. We're neighbors. We're virtual neighbors on the internet and here at WUNC. Thank you very much for being on the program, and thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.